Welcome to the Women in Product podcast. I'm Elizabeth Ames. Over the next few months, we'll be sharing a special series on AI and product. In this series, we're going to take a deep dive into how AI is changing product management. We'll explore the exciting product opportunities and challenges that come with it. Join us as we chat with industry experts and uncover the latest trends, strategies, and innovations that'll keep you and your products one step ahead. This is the second episode in our new series on AI, and we'll be talking with Marilee Nika about demystifying AI. Marilee is the founder of AI Product Academy, where she delivers live, cohort-based courses on AI and product management. Prior to starting AI Product Academy, Marilee was the AI product lead at Meta's Reality Labs. Before that, she was the AI product lead for Google Glass Experiences. Marilee holds both a Master's of Science and a PhD in Computer Science from Imperial College in London. Rashmi Ramesh, who was the creator and host of our Path to CPO podcast series, will be interviewing Marilee. Rashmi is a seasoned professional in product management and has held leadership roles across public companies and startups in the enterprise space. She also has an MBA from Wharton. I'll let Rashmi and Marilee take it from here.
Welcome, Marilee. Welcome to Women in Product, and we are so excited to have you here. And you will be our first guest for our AI product series about demystifying AI. So let's get started with the first simple question, where I've really loved the way you explain AI to your three-year-old daughter. And for those who don't know about this, tell us how you explained that and how you thought about that, actually. And, you know, what is all this buzz around AI about from your perspective?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. So I have a three-year-old daughter, and we recently were learning the animals. We were walking down the street, and we would see dogs or we would see cats at people's houses. And I would tell her, hey, this is what a dog looks like. This is what a cat looks like. This is what a dog looks like. This is what a cat looks like. And then eventually we would see an animal, and I wouldn't say what kind of animal it was. And she turned to me and she's like, I think this is a cat. And it was very interesting to see her say, I think, because that's exactly how machine learning and AI works. If you provide a lot of label data, for example, let's say label data with photos of cats and photos of dogs, you put them in the system is going to learn. Eventually, it's going to tell you that there is a probability that this is a cat or this is a dog if a new image comes in that doesn't have a label. But it really dawned to me when she said, I think this is a cat, I think this is a dog. That's exactly what machine learning does. It will give you a probability as to whether what it's looking at is a cat or a dog. And this is a very simple example, obviously. It's a classification algorithm. But, you know, we can learn so much from our kids in conjunction to AI.
Yeah, absolutely. I think such a complex topic was so simply explained and analyzed, I thought was really beautiful. And continuing on this, you know, AI has been around since, I think, 1950s. And over the past few years, we have seen various use cases for predictive analysis, recommendation engines, personalization, et cetera, where AI were already used as a technology. And according to you, why has the Gen AI really taken the world by storm?
Well, first of all, Gen AI has been around forever. However, we're now able to see it at scale because of hardware advancements, because of chips that allow machines to run such complex calculations, let's say, so that we can get, you know, the experience that we get when we go on ChatGPT, on Bard, and so on. But it's incredible to be able, within an instance, to add as an input, let's say, a doc to all these machines and then get the summary out of it, or to be able to get these photos and images generated, or to generate video to video, image to video, and all these things. I think it completely opens up a whole new world of potential for our day-to-day life, personally, day-to-day life at work. And I'm sure like everyone is now talking about how Gen AI has really transformed the way they work. We have the time to spend our cognitive load in more important tasks than like tedious things. We can have it correct documents for us. There's just so much that Gen AI can do for us. I actually teach a generative AI for product managers course just because it has transformed my day to day. And I want to tell people, hey, here's what you can do. And it can change your own lives as well.
I love the point where you mentioned about, you know, whole new potential on a day-to-day basis, which is accessibility to every single person, I guess, who has access to computers, to this technology, which was kind of before only with a limited set of companies or limited set of people, but now everyone and anyone can actually access as long as you can type, I guess. So love that. And further extending your thoughts on the AI field and adoption, you know, there have been many technological advances over the course of time, right? With previously been the cloud adoption, and now with AI. How do you think this technology really affects the product management function per se?
Well, someone asked me and they said, hey, is my job going to be automated? Am I no longer needed? Because we saw Airbnb, they said they're not going to have product managers anymore.
Right.
But what I say is that AI is not going to take over product managers, but product managers that leverage AI will take over product managers that do not. So it's very important for people to realize that adopting AI in your day-to-day is not a... it's not an option. It's not a luxury. It is a necessity that we need to do in order to stay ahead, in order to be able to perform and be the best that we can in our profession.
That's very well said. It's not a it's a necessity currently. It's almost table stakes now. Coming to our main topic about demystifying AI, right? So let's start from, you know, one of the things that you mentioned. Going to the basics of it, like who is this AI PM? And I know you talk a lot about that every PM can be an AI PM. Let's talk more about that.
Yep. All product managers will be AI product managers in the future. And the AI PM, and I love the way you ask this question, which is who is this AI PM? Well, it's someone that is comfortable in an experimental nature at work. It's someone that is comfortable having a complete blank canvas and trying to make hypotheses that they are going to test and validate and then go back to the complete empty sounding board and so on. So the product management role within AI has to do a lot with just asking the right question, figuring out what the right problem to solve is versus just running around and being able to build immediately in order to solve pain points. Let's use an example. Let's say we have the technology to convert text to image, okay? If I am an AI PM, let's say at Adobe, I will come in, I will see that, okay, this technology is there. But AI alone is not a product, okay? AI is not a product. So I need to figure out how to leverage that technology in order to figure out if there are any pain points on the user's end that I can solve. So what people at Adobe did, they said, well, we want to figure out a way to find product market fit for this AI product. And as we all know, in order to find product market fit, we need to fulfill three bubbles. Bubble number one, having something that's feasible from a technical perspective, having something that is going to be desirable by humans, and then having something that's viable from a business perspective. So what Adobe did is they said, well, we are going to focus on designers because this is our user base. They do pay on a monthly basis with subscriptions. So they do check the viability from a business perspective box. And they are going to come up with a new experience because of this technology. Now, the new experience they came up with that I love is you can literally generate like a little template for, let's say, invitations or anything your client may ask. If I'm a client and I go to someone that's a designer and say, hey, I want to invite for a three-year-old girl birthday party that has a turtle, that's pink, that has a bow, whatever. The designer will be able to literally type this in the system and then get that image instantly. And then they just add it in a template for an invite, they tweak it a bit, boom, done, sell it. So they also take the user desirability box right there. So Gen AI is really transforming the way we do work. But we do need to realize AI is not a product. We need to figure out ways to leverage the technology into a way that solves user problems. And Adobe did such a great job. Like, I think they really hit the nail. Is that the expression? They did a great job with finding product market fit.
That's right. I think there's so much there to unpack. So we want to talk about one other aspect about the impression that is there in the market that one really needs to have a computer science degree in order to be successful as an AI PM. What's your take on that, Murali, since we're really here to, you know, demystify this black box called AI?
Okay, this is a great question. And I have actually founded an AI product management academy that has an AI PM bootcamp program, which is exactly for people that feel they need to have a technical background, they need to have a PhD. Short answer is they do not. All people need to understand in order to become AI PMs is what AI is, how they can leverage it, and how they can work with research scientists in order to bring it to life. Now, more specifically, there is a set amount of different algorithms that can be leveraged to solve different types of user problems. Now, the standard user problems, or rather the standard features that we can use, are a better recommendation algorithm, a better matching in our dating app, let's say, generating content, of course, automating some workflows, scaling an experience, and overall, coming up using these AI capabilities in a way to bring a great user experience to life. So all we need to know is that there are specific algorithms that can get leveraged for specific capabilities that we can provide. Now, day-to-day has some specific kind of... On your day-to-day life as an AI product manager, you will work with AI research scientists, right? Mm-hmm. And working with this specific group of folks is a bit different than standard software engineers in the sense that, as I said, like, you need to be comfortable with the experimental nature of the role. So you come up with a hypothesis, you scope it down, you need to figure out where to collect data, you need to figure out what's the right metric to measure success for this capability that you want to offer. You need to be used to failing at that hypothesis you make and needed to go back from scratch very, very often. So there is an element of hard skills, which is, you know, understanding the algorithms and capabilities, but also soft skills, which is to establish technical influence with your research team and also to be able to lead a team in this very vague experimental nature. So very, very often it has happened to me where something we were all building for like 3 months just fell apart and we had to completely pivot. And it's up to you, the PM, to make sure people are feeling comfortable and they can kind of keep moving forward with the same amount of excitement and admiration for your product.
Yeah, no, that's very well said, because often sometimes all the technical aspects just get so overwhelming that, you know, your soft skills are still so critical, your problem solving skills are so critical, but you tend to focus on the skills that you don't have and kind of get scared about it, right? So that's very well said.
Absolutely.
So what are the aspects of AI that you want our listeners to really get comfortable with and really cross this chasm of being a successful AI PM leader? So what aspects of AI product management that, you know, people should not be scared about?
A huge deal about being an AI PM is the fact that you will need to make trade-offs that are very difficult on a day-to-day basis. These trade-offs are trade-offs such as privacy versus personalization, accuracy versus user experience. And these kind of calls, it all comes down to being the product manager. Like, you're the PM, you're going to make the decision as to whether something is good enough to launch, whether you have like the right blend of these trade-offs that I talked to you about. There is this concept of MVQ. So MVQ is the minimum viable quality of a product. And I find that when we come up with an AI MVP or like a prototype of an experience that leverages AI, it's just going to be awful in the beginning because you're not going to have enough data. You're not going to have trained your models in the right ways. But you will want to launch something out there in the world, and you will want to figure out what's the minimum quality bar you can meet for it to be worth it to bring out in the world. So that's the concept is called MVQ, minimal viable quantity. And let me speak in a specific example. So I was working for Google's speech team, for example, and research scientists would come to us and say, hey, we can recognize, you know, a voice 6 out of 10 times at a time. This is just an example for illustration purposes. Mm-hmm. But they would come to me and they would say, hey, if we recognize, you know, that someone is speaking 6 out of 10 times, what does that do for the user experience? Should we launch it? Should we not launch it? And that's where strategy comes in AI product management as well. And a lot of people don't really realize how big strategy is in this specific field. So for example, you will need to answer things like, well, should I launch even though I don't have an optimal experience? Mm-hmm. Should I do a little closed beta? Should I wait and launch, you know, after having a pristine product? If we're a company like Apple and user experience is everything to us and everything needs to be pristine, hardware, software, you're really not going to be the first to go into market for this sort of kind of experimental purposes. So to summarize, there are quite a few things that you need to know as an AI PM. Number one is that you may not have a great product on day one. Like your MVP is literally just going to be there for you to collect more data, for you to be the pioneer in your field. Number three, trade-offs is going to be such a huge part of the role. And if you're uncomfortable with, you know, standing your ground and making very difficult decisions, then this might not be the role for you.
That's amazingly said. And this is the first time I heard you speak about MVQ, actually, which is pretty awesome to think about it. And it makes so much sense in the realm of AI, AI products and the product management part of it. You talked a little bit about some of these trade-offs being made and how big the strategy, the importance of strategy is with some of these. How do we kind of get equipped with AI? I know you talked about your course as well. If you think about the AI tech stack and given the number of resources that's out there, right, which is kind of impossible to keep a tab on, and every day things are also changing, you know, what are the different categories of topics that the PMs need to be familiar with in order to successfully build AI products?
Number one, people need to understand the process. How does it work? What is the AI lifecycle? You know, we collect data, we train a model, we test the accuracy. If we collect the data, we have like a huge data set. We need to split that data set into the training data, which is going to be used for us to train our model, and then into our test data so that we can use that in order to assess kind of the accuracy and how well this model is performing. So number one, the process, AI lifecycle. Number two, the different types of algorithms there are. You as a PM are not going to have to decide the implementation strategy, but you should be able to understand what a classifier is, what a recommendation algorithm is, how you can surface content. Let's say you're a Spotify PM and you want to build a nice recommender system, an engine, so that you can surface the right content to mm-hmm. someone else. So you need to understand basic understanding on the algorithm so that when your team is telling you, hey, here's the algorithm I'm using to build this, you are going to feel like, oh, okay, you kind of understand what is going on. And the other thing is, what does success look like in AI product management? We talked a bit about accuracy, but accuracy is not everything. In AI product management, it's actually a blend of metrics we will need to look into. For example, I have a newsletter and I wrote an article about this and I had a little glass and had like little ice cubes that represented mm-hmm. different buckets of metrics. So you do have your standard product health metrics like, you know, engagement, retention, referral, all these things. You also have your accuracy of your model. But that's not everything. Everything has to do with a combination of metrics that can assess whether an experience is good. So measuring success in AI product management is important. Strategy as well, as I said, this is also equally important. And then the last thing is technology moves so fast. We need to get used to just moving and pivoting quickly from something that we're already used to. Good example is, I don't know if you saw that, but like ChatGPT allowed the ability of people to create custom GPTs. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Actually created an AI product GPT where you it's a custom one where you literally input what you do and it tells you how to make your product an AI product. It generates a PRD and like a little mock. It's cool. But there were many startups that came up after ChatGPT got created. And it was startups that they had an interface and you could create custom GPTs and you would pay and so on. But then ChatGPT said, hey, we provide for free the ability for you to create a custom GPT. So like all these businesses and startups kind of got discarded immediately. So people need to be very comfortable with constant pivoting and constant just switching gears and not get disappointed. Like that's a very big mental shift that I had to do. I get very emotionally attached with what I'm building, but with AI, I'm like, okay, it is what it is. This may change from day to day. So
that's the yeah, I feel the same as well. So how can you kind of showcase these necessary skills if you've not been an AI PM, but you've actually built some of the amazing products previously, be it B2C products or B2B products? How can you show some of these aspects of, you know, hey, we can constantly pivot. I did this previously. You know, these are the kind of trade-offs I've done. Any thoughts on how you could kind of position yourself, you know, in order to showcase that aspect of it?
For people that have built 0-to-1 products, I feel they're better positioned than people that have not. Because in 0-to-1 product management, you have a complete blank canvas, or you're trying to figure out what to build if, you know, there is an opportunity for you to build something meaningful for users. So if you've done 0-to-1, you can definitely make kind of a pitch for yourself and say, look, I'm already comfortable with building businesses from ground up. Now, using AI is, sure, it's different, but I can still leverage my existing experience to this domain. So there's that. Number two, there are people that have been AI PMs without knowing they are AI PMs. These are people that have worked with scientists and engineers to bring some capability to life that's smart, just like the ones I talked about before, being able to match, suggest, recommend, scale, automate, and so on. So I guess the first thing I would ask people is look into all your past launches and figure out if engineers used an element of AI, if they use an element of learning through data that essentially means that you work with machine learning. So that's the number one. Another point I want to mention is that when you work with AI, and let's say you have some, you know, research scientists giving you some insights and telling you, hey, here's the accuracy you have, here's what the experience looks like in an experimental server. When you take this experience and you productionize it, meaning when you go through the hoops of productionizing, integrating with other systems, getting live for millions of users to use, that experience and quality may significantly drop. So having gone through some experience where you productionize some technology in the wild, even if it does not use AI, is great experience that you can leverage for an interview and say, look, I'm comfortable with like massive complex technologies that need productionization. We needed to kind of think on our feet and be able to like patch and hack the experience just to make sure it's good enough for the users. Yeah, I think these are the things I had in mind.
I know you talked a little bit about, you know, we have the product metrics, but then you have additional set of metrics from an AI standpoint, one being just the quality of it, right? What's kind of good enough and what is not. So tell us a little bit more about, you know, through these experiments that you go through, what are some of the lagging indicators and leading indicators that, hey, you are in the right direction per se?
It's very easy to get lost in the AI world. When you work with, you know, machine learning scientists, their entire world is, you know, about the tests and the experiments they're running. And, you know, a lot of them also publish research in conferences. And, you know, they have completely different goals when it comes to research that's published. But when you're a PM, you care about the experience that you're putting together. So at the end of the day, you may literally care about increasing retention on the feature, let's say, or increasing engagement or monetization or whatever. And the strategy you use in order to increase that metric uses AI. But ultimately, the way you measure success is with the product health metric. So I want to keep reminding to people that even if you may be using AI, it's all about the product. It's all about the users at the end of the day. So using AI does not mean we need to change the way we measure things, the way we track things. Now, before AI, I wouldn't really pay too much attention on system health metrics such as, you know, throughput or latency, anything like that. But with AI, I want to make sure these are tracked as well because they can significantly affect the experience of the user. A good example is, again, OpenAI. They had launched their Plus, their membership, which is $20 a month. And then when they launched custom GPTs, they only allowed premium users to have the ability to create custom GPTs. So essentially what happened there is, I think Sam Altman, just the CEO, made a tweet and said, hey, we actually turned off the capability of people signing up to be premium members because we just cannot handle the traffic. Our servers are done. So as an AI PM, it's also important to keep a track of the system health metrics that were underrated, that people were kind of not paying too much attention on. But yeah, it's these three baggage of metrics: product health, which is the primary one, AI proxy metrics like accuracy, and then system health.
That's awesome. It's an awesome reminder for the system metrics, given I think for a long time with all the cloud adoption, we've forgotten about it. I think now is a good time to bring those back and remember that those are important as well. So that's a great insight because there are many different problems, you know, many kinds of use cases that one can do. But how do you think about, is this a good use case for AI?
And that is something I teach folks. And I said, make sure that you will use AI because you need to use AI. Don't use AI for the sake of using AI. There was actually a startup that I was advising and they were building this amazing experience. It was an experience for vacation. You would travel somewhere and then AI would generate your itinerary, where to go, what to do based on your demographics, the type of vacation, if you're with family or not, and so on. And they told me, hey, we're trying to build an MVP and we don't have enough data to train a model. And I said, well, that's because you don't need to train a model. What you're trying to do right now is validate a hypothesis. And that hypothesis is, hey, there is value in an automated itinerary for people that are traveling that can solve XYZ pain point. There's no need to get into figuring out what data to use and what models to train because you're just not going to need that. And they were very surprised. And they said, well, but we are an AI startup. And I said, you have not validated anything right now. So until you validate the hypothesis and the point, and then you convince me that AI is the best way to go to generate this, I don't see the use of AI and the need for it. So step number one, make sure that AI is the only way you can solve a specific pain point. Make sure that these capabilities we talked about, which is generating content, generating insights, better suggestion, better matching, all these things are only capable by using specific, you know, machine learning techniques. And there is a lot of trial and error. There is a lot of hypothesis testing. There is a lot of building, pivoting quickly. I was looking into some stats, but like if you leverage AI, you're 5 times more likely to pivot from your original plan versus not using AI to solve a problem. And I found it interesting. And as a personality, I need this change and I need this challenge and moving fast. If not, I'm going to get bored. So I just love using AI for these purposes.
That's awesome. And again, a really good reminder for good to have versus I really need to have this technology to solve a problem. I think, yeah, thanks for explaining that. I know we talk a lot about frameworks and things from a product management perspective. Any frameworks or tools that you could share in order for one to be a successful AI PM or a PM leader?
So someone recently asked me, what is the best way to come up with ideas that leverage AI? And I actually put together the simplest spreadsheet where I have on one side the kind of user segments that you want to solve for, and then I have the capabilities that AI can be leveraged for in order to solve these. And I have little arrows, and you can mix and match and say, okay, this capability can solve this. This can solve this. I'm happy to share it with people. It's on my newsletter. It helped me so much to kind of wrap my mind around how, you know, a pain point can be solved with AI in a very tangible way. So I'm happy to share with people. And then the other framework that's not AI, but I use it on a day-to-day basis is the standard RISE framework for prioritization. It's just so valid even with AI use cases, which essentially means prioritize based on these four factors: reach, impact, confidence, and then you divide all that by the effort that it's going to take. But with AI, RISE changes because the effort is like so much more significant, and the confidence also changes because you don't know if you're going to find the data that you need to train a model, and you don't know what the quality of the data is going to look like and what the end result will be.
Well, that's awesome. I'm sure the spreadsheet that you mentioned would be super useful for, I think, all our listeners. We can definitely share the link with them. And before we move further, I think I should really ask you this question about, you know, you were a data scientist before. What really made you transition to being a PM, specifically in AI?
Very good question. Well, I remember I was doing a PhD in machine learning, and then I did, as part of it, an internship at Facebook. I was a data science intern. And I just remember my day-to-day, I was literally going in, diving into the data, trying to find the answers to questions that came to me. But I had so many ideas, and I had so many questions on the questions, and I had so many suggestions about different questions and all these things. So I was always very creative. I was always very passionate. I was always thinking about the end user and not the process itself. And then after finishing my PhD, Google reached out, and I ended up joining the speech team, where the technology was converting text into transcript. And I kind of came in, worked with other PMs, and we tried to figure out what problems we can solve that leverages technology. And I just loved it. I loved the fact that I had to think, that I had to pitch my ideas, that I had to work with other amazing, smart people to craft and put journeys and experiences to life. And the most important thing was, you know, launching something and then seeing, looking at the data and at the engagement going up, and then millions of users using what you created was just magical for me. So it kind of found me. I didn't know product management existed when I was studying, and I wish I did, because if I did, I think I would have done anything I can to study everything around product management. Because, you know, ultimately I would have known that this is the field I would want to pursue.
It's always amazing to see one's journey into product management and such unique paths in there. What do you think have been some of the risks while building AI products, and kind of how do you mitigate them? Because the risks that you see in normal product lifecycle that are relevant for AI as well, but AI as a technology brings in a lot more than that. So would love to hear your take on that.
Yes, absolutely. Being fair, ethical, inclusive, there are so many challenges there. And I think a lot of it starts with data. How do we track data? Do we have permission to track that specific data? Number two, is the data we track inclusive enough? Are we tracking from many different sources that are representative of the world? Number three, how do we process the data? What happens if that data include, you know, personalized information, PII, and so on? What are governmental, you know, laws and specific local regulations that we need to pursue? So there's just so much. And I find that a lot of people in the beginning got so excited about, you know, AI and the capabilities that kind of overlooked kind of these big challenges. So there is a profession which is definitely overlooked, and not just overlooked, it's like it doesn't get the value it deserves, which is ops, machine learning operations, product operations, which has to do with the process of moving data around, cleaning the data, making sure the collection of the data is legitimate and fair. That is so important. An AI system is going to be as good as its data. So we need to make sure to always collect data that's representative, to clean it, to make sure there's no private information there, to give control to the people that provided this data for us, to delete it if they want to. And, you know, this is just, I don't feel it's mature enough, this field. I'm just very passionate about privacy, and I actually hope my next role is going to be in something around that. I think that's where I see my next impactful kind of step to be.
And in this process of you know, the data cleansing and making sure it's not biased in one way or the other in things, how do you see the involvement of both product management and the data scientists working together here, or is it more skewed towards one function?
That's the thing. These considerations need to be a part of every single function's day role. Like, it needs to be something we all consider. There was some company, and they were telling me, well, you know, there is, as part of the review process, there is a step to make sure things are ethical and fair. But I say, wait, if it's just a step and not every function throughout the development lifecycle is not considering this, then I don't feel this is like the right way to go. So every function needs to consider this. The PM primarily, of course, should make sure to call it out. But also in QA, we need to specifically make sure to test specific things about inclusivity, about fairness. And in some instances, it's actually, it makes sense to use data that's already collected, that's out there, that has already been vetted and is clean, so that we can make sure, you know, it just ticks all these boxes that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's a great call out. And I think it goes back to the thing that you mentioned about, you know, AI product management is more of a strategy that's imbibed into every function and not just one or two, not just with the PMs or data scientists per se, to begin with. I know we touched a little bit upon, you know, the AI product development lifecycle itself. Could you kind of elaborate on, you know, we all understand from just a regular product development process that we have, but how does this look like for AI products specifically?
Very good question. So essentially, as an AI PM, you're sprinkling in AI along the way throughout the AI product development lifecycle. So you are likely going to start with some technology. As I said, you'll have like a speech to text technology, and you need to figure out who this could be used for. So you always start with users. Who could this help? And then you make hypotheses and you say, well, it could help X cohort of people because of X use case, because of X pain point. And then you're trying to kind of validate this hypothesis after doing some market research. I focus so much on market research because it's likely to save so much time and money and effort. So that's kind of the second step. The third step is prototype, implement, build an AI MVP, so that you can literally train some model without having any meaningful experience, you know, like the most basic experience you can imagine. Get some preliminary data, talk to some dog fooders, discuss, see if your initial hypothesis for this specific user segment, for this specific pain point, if you actually are solving this. And after you do this, you will do some testing, you'll collect more data based on the responses and what people said. If everything looks good and the MVQ is good enough, so the minimum viable quantity, you can discuss rolling out. So rollout is the other one. You'll figure out how to bring it out in the wild, how to bring it out in the world. So these are the steps. But of course, there's, you know, if I could add arrows, I would have so many backs and forths between each one of them, just because you're pivoting all the time and you want to make sure to do this right.
Right. No, that's a great way of saying that. How do you kind of advise them with respect to experimentation? Because there's a cost associated now with each of those, right? So how do you see that with, especially from an advising the startup's perspective?
It's kind of a fine line because you don't want to shut down on an idea that may end up being amazing, but it looks kind of crazy. Like if someone came to me and said, hey, we'll create a little interface that it will leverage, you know, a GPT that has been trained to answer questions, and this is gonna completely transform the entire world, but we need 20 billion to, I don't know, I'm just coming up with numbers. the risk would be massive. So you want to take risks, but you want to find the balance between taking risks and getting the answers you want. I honestly think it all comes down to the people that are claiming they can do something and whether they have the passion, the curiosity, the expertise, and whether you feel that the combination of the specific team can pull things off. So yeah, it has to do with the team, has to do with the people. But also I want people to be open to new ideas, especially more traditional companies. Because, you know, if you don't adapt, there's a risk of facing extinction, right? Like a lot of companies had to face.
Yeah. And maybe one last question, like what opportunities do you see specifically from a product management function in the future?
So no matter what people are working on, whether it's a traditional company or a more advanced or a big or like a startup, there is opportunity to enhance your existing product offerings by leveraging AI. And when I say enhance, it all comes down to providing a better user experience. Again, with the capabilities we discussed, there's also an amazing opportunity for people that will provide AI as a service, whether this is some new no-code tool you provide, some new insights tool you provide, something that can remove the complicated steps of the AI lifecycle. I had a student, and when we were learning the AI lifecycle as part of my bootcamp, he got so fascinated with the different ways you can go about collecting data, especially when I talked about how there are third-party agencies that literally collect the data you want. And he actually created an agency that gets out there and collects custom data for any company that wants it. And he's just loving every step of it. So if you're a product manager, just keep your eye and mind open to how you can enhance your current offerings. Go to your leadership and literally recommend an R&D department where you can just discuss, come up with ideas, have some engineer to prototype new things, because you never know what kind of new offerings you can provide. And I had wrote this on LinkedIn the other day. AI is not about what it's going to do now for us, but it's also what it's going to do for us in the future. So for example, if now you're a nurse, in the future, you may create kind of a service that's going to provide a digital service automatically online for people that need such services. If you're an art agency, you can incorporate Gen AI. So in your next role, you can be the consultant that builds solutions instead of agencies. So there's just so much it can do for us now, but also please look into what AI can do for you 5 years down the road. I don't want anyone to be afraid of it. Please adopt it. Please embrace it. It has the potential to ground break, to change the world.
Anything else you want to add to the folks listening from, you know, demystifying AI? And I hope at least after this conversation and listening to you, you know, there are people who are not embracing AI yet, feel more comfortable to take the first steps and move towards it.
Yeah, AI is so much more than just Gen AI. AI is all around us. Like if you have a smart Nest that can learn, you know, the thermostat that can learn the temperatures, not just itself, that's AI. If you're using Google Photos of your phone, that's AI because it can group photos together. If you're using Alexa or Google Home, all of these devices, that is AI. So AI is way more than just Gen AI, but I'm grateful for Gen AI because it has shed light to what we have been working on for over 10 years. And yeah, please don't be afraid of it. And please reach out to me. I'm always happy to meet new people on LinkedIn. And of course, join my AI product bootcamp if you want to get certified and learn how to become an AI PM.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. And thanks also to our partner, Discover, who provides annual support for the work of Women in Product. And thank you to our community. This podcast is an original production of Women in Product. Follow us on Apple Podcast and leave us a review so that others can discover us. Android users, find us on Spotify or share this episode with others who you think would find it interesting.